Welcome to this special Web Extra audio segment of Lung Cancer Update and additional comments by both our speakers, beginning with Dr. Bruce Johnson, who discussed tissue testing for squamous cell lung cancer.
Well, you know, one of the things that happens, and we're big believers, you got to walk before you run. And as you know from having looked at that, we've looked at our initial 100 patients who had the next generation platform. And there's potential targets within there. None of them yet have the clear predictive value that we have in non-squamous. We had great hopes of the FGFR family being able to be activated either by mutations or rearrangements. Certainly the mutants don't look to be as predictive as we would have hoped for the FGFR family. The one that looks most promising is the FGFR3 rearrangements, where there's some evidence with some of the FGFR inhibitors. The other one that's been somewhat problematic in lung is that one of the pathways we had high hopes of seeing activation of the PI3 kinase pathway, either by mutations within PI3 kinase or inactivations of P10. And thus far, the PI3 kinase inhibitors have been somewhat disappointing in this clinical situation. We are very strong believers that the first and most important step in doing personalized therapy by targeting specific mutations is to first consistently identify the mutants. And then secondly, once you define the mutants, make certain that you have a drug that's active against that particular mutant form. And we're ever the optimists. We think that this is a solvable problem, and we think that there's going to be targets that one can effectively treat in squamous cell carcinoma. As far as I'm concerned, at the current time, doing systematic characterization of squamous cell carcinoma of the lung is an investigation. It's a research test and not a clinical test.
Your colleagues in breast cancer down the hall have done a lot of work with CDK4/6 inhibitors, abemaciclib, et cetera. What do we know about these agents in lung cancer?
Well, we've had investigational studies using the CDK4/6 inhibitors. One of my colleagues, Jeff Shapiro, combines this with MEK inhibitors, and we have a research program taking a look at this. I have tried to send most of my patients with KRAS mutations for treatment with the CDK4/6 inhibitors plus one of the MEK inhibitors, and we've seen some evidence of anti-tumor activities in this group. The published information on the MEK inhibitors are somewhat of a challenge to use. They have a good bit of skin and ocular toxicity, and so it's not simple to combine the CDK4/6 inhibitors, and they don't have a terrible amount of activity as single agents, so it's currently being combined. So right now, we believe that this is an area that's useful to look at in a research mode, but currently it's not something that is quite ready for moving into prime time.
Let's close out talking about checkpoint inhibitors. Maybe you can present your 74-year-old man.
He was an older gentleman who, once again, he showed up with brain mets and had it treated locally with a craniotomy and then had localized therapy to the others, and then got paclitaxel carbo in 2012 and initially had stable and then progressive disease. This is one where, you know, at the time, I certainly, because he had an adenocarcinoma, I would have given him PEM-CIS or PEM-CARBO. And then when I saw him, we switched him to second-line PEM that he got for 7 months. So it's a little bit longer than what you typically see. And they had an increase, and then he had the brain mets plus hyalur and mediastinal adenopathy, so we elected to give him radiation therapy. And he was observed off therapy for 4 months, and then he developed progressive disease in a neck mass. And at the time, it required a fresh biopsy for PD-L1 before you treated him with pembrolizumab, and you had to have at least 1% PD-L1 positivity in your tumor mass to go on the study. And he ended up going on, and he was on for about 8 months. So he had a nice symptomatic response. And the other thing that happens, he was sort of an anxious person and he would feel his neck all the time. And every visit, he'd wonder if it was a little bit bigger, a little bit smaller. It didn't have a dramatic response. You know, it didn't sort of shrink and all go away, but he was pretty much asymptomatic for those 8 months and was able to work on a regular basis outside and was very active and had fewer, almost no complications. The other thing was he had pretty bad osteoarthritis. He didn't have rheumatoid arthritis, and I was a little bit concerned about what would happen to his joints with this because, you know, that's one of the things you get, arthralgias, myalgias, and some inflammation, but it didn't seem to bother him, didn't exacerbate his arthritis. And then he went through a number of other therapies afterwards. The other reason why I present him is that we've been able to study the cells, particularly people who have pleural effusions, and he had a pleural effusion, so he tapped it. And one of the things that my colleagues did was to take a look both in preclinical as well as clinical situations about reasons why the checkpoint inhibitors quit working. And one of the things that they ended up observing in patients who developed progression is they did upregulation of one of the immunomodulatory agents, TIM-3, which is one of the effectors in the immunotherapy pathway. And one of the things that they've done in preclinical models is give both a checkpoint inhibitor plus a TIM-3 inhibitor in patients who develop progression after they get checkpoint inhibition and can actually show a prolongation in survival, which is going to lead to some of the preclinical evidence of combining those two agents for immunotherapy.
Yeah, I've had some fascinating discussions with Chuck Drake from Hopkins about, I think it's TIM-3 and LAG-3 of alternative mechanisms. Are there agents right now that attack these other mechanisms?
Yeah, they're becoming available to be able to do investigational treatments with. The other observation, they had LAG-3 that went up as well in these patients, but the most significant one was TIM-3, and so that's the one that is going to be pursued.
How did he do in terms of tolerance of the pembrolizumab?
He tolerated extremely well. You know, we've treated hundreds of patients with checkpoint inhibitors. In general, you know, they tolerate it. Typically the grade 3 to 5 toxicities with this run between 10 and 20%. That is pretty manageable for lung cancer. The other one that we worry about in these patients is pneumonitis. You know, we see pneumonitis both with the EGFR TKIs as well as the checkpoint inhibitors. The pneumonitis comes on at a similar time as what we see with the TKIs. You know, it can be a few weeks or a few months into it. And it typically runs at about 1% or 2%. So it's sort of similar to the frequency of what we see with the TKIs, and it's one of the things you end up needing to be cognizant of.
I mean, when you say 10 to 20%, that kind of sounds high when I ask people. I mean, it may be in the literature 10 to 20%, but I mean, and you treated hundreds of patients. You know, you're talking about autoimmune complications that are grade 3 and grade 4 to that level?
Yeah, I mean, that's the published literature. It's about 10 to 20% grade 3 and 4 with pembrolizumab and nivolumab.
And in your clinical experience, you think that jives with that?
Yeah, but the toxicities, one of the things that happens is as opposed to the EGFR TKIs where it's almost all rash and diarrhea, this is a real mixture of grade 3 to 5 so that there's no one toxicity that is dominant. I mentioned the pneumonitis. You know, it's also diarrhea, you know, GI toxicity. You can also get a bit of a skin rash with these. And then there's the other unusual ones of, you know, the ones of interest where you can develop hypophysitis and develop thyroiditis associated with these. You know, there's some unusual ones. I haven't seen it in any of the patients I've treated, and that's why we mention it.
How do you approach the selection of the checkpoint inhibitor you're going to utilize, pembrolizumab versus nivolumab?
We've personally worked more with pembrolizumab than we have with nivolumab just because of the studies that we do. And I think this is where it becomes very important when you're out in private practice. What do you do? Because nivolumab is approved for both squamous and non-squamous non-small cell lung carcinoma without a marker. And one of the things that happens and that's pretty clear is that with squamous cell lung cancer in the second line, there's a very substantial benefit for giving nivolumab over giving docetaxel, you know, both in terms of survival and the progression-free survival is a bit better. And there's not a dramatic impact of using the marker of PD-L1. Now, I'll come back to the PD-L1 issue. With pembrolizumab, in order for the patients to go on, they had to have at least 1% PD-L1 positivity in their tumors. And for part of them, they needed to have a fresh biopsy. It's a little hard to compare to cross studies because they use different tests for the PD-L1 positivity. Now, for pembrolizumab study, about 2/3 of the patients had at least 1% PD-L1 positivity to go in the pembrolizumab study. And the pembrolizumab was just published in Lancet, where they took a look at two different doses of those patients and it showed survival advantages for it. Now, the other thing is, going back to nivolumab, is that in the non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, the benefit was a bit more modest. And in that group, they ended up seeing a difference in benefit for the patients that were, by their criteria, PD-L1 positive for the non-squamous. And, you know, in non-squamous, depending on how you're treating them, if they don't have an oncogenic driver you want to treat, the benefit over chemotherapy is a bit less dramatic than it is in the squamous cell carcinomas. So if you don't have a marker, although it's approved in non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer, of giving it without a marker, you know, as I said before, the benefit is a bit more modest. As a matter of fact, the progression-free survival favors chemotherapy, but you end up seeing an advantage later on. I think one of the things that all of us are very anxious to see is what happens longer term, because the big difference that you end up seeing where the curves separate, both with squamous and non-squamous, is about 18 months, where you see more than a twofold difference in both progression-free as well as survival. And, you know, if indeed there's a very long tail on the curve, what we hope is that, you know, it may be as in melanoma, where some of these patients will go out 5 years or longer with the responses, it's going to be a real game changer, and we eagerly await information.
Listening to what you just said, does that mean that in general with metastatic squamous, you use Nivo?
Off trial, and if we don't have a marker, we'll use nivolumab.
So when you say you don't have a marker, do you get PD-L1 levels on all your patients?
Yeah, we have the ability of measuring PD-L1. Now, the one thing we don't know, because it's a proprietary test, is we don't know exactly what our PD-L1 positivity means relative to the published information on nivolumab and pembrolizumab. But we find it helpful for looking at patients and making decisions to know what their PD-L1 status is.
One final question about this. You mentioned the fact that this man had some arthritis, although it was degenerative. How do you approach the issue of patients with a history of a prior autoimmune disease, Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, multiple sclerosis? Particularly, you have a patient who's gotten in the second line setting with metastatic disease who doesn't have too many other options.
Well, I think it's a real challenge because the patients were excluded from the trials who had autoimmune disease. And at the current time, I base my judgment on what type of autoimmune disease they have. So for instance, they have psoriasis that is troublesome but not crippling. I would consider putting that person on a checkpoint inhibitor therapy to see what happens. You know, when you get to things such as systemic lupus erythematosus or some other disease, ulcerative colitis, where they still have their colon in, I would be much more reticent to begin treating patients in that setting until that's specifically looked at in an investigational study.
Any new initiatives related to checkpoint inhibitors that you're particularly excited about or enthusiastic about? One that obviously has entered melanoma is the combination of an anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 antibody with anti-CTLA-4 antibody. What do we know about that in lung cancer?
Well, we've used it in a couple of different settings. It's been tested now in mesothelioma, and it's also being tested in non-small cell lung cancer. And in particular in ones where even that are PD-L1 negative, and certainly there is anti-tumor activity, it's a bit of a challenge to use because the combination is relatively toxic, so you end up needing to adjust the doses of the drugs. And the CTLA-4 ends up, the ipilimumab ends up being only typically given for about 4 courses, and then the checkpoint inhibitors go on indefinitely, and we'll wait and see what happens. You know, the initial experience is it doesn't look like that sort of dramatic responses that they saw and long-living responses that they see in melanoma. At first pass, it doesn't look like that's going to be exactly reproduced from the publicly presented information, but we'll wait and see what happens with the combination treatment.